Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean,
days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Thanks for listening. Today on the podcast, Shastri Ethan Nickturn. He is the author of One City, A Declaration of Interdependence. Wow, that's a deep cut at this point. He's written two books since then, Dave. What are you talking about? He's the author of The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path. And most recently, he's the author of The Dharma of the Princess Bride. That's probably the book I should have started with. But you know what? I'm not a publisher, so there. He's also leading a Shambhala Training Weekend 1 meditation retreat this coming weekend, weekend of January 19th, Shambhala Training Level 1, and he's co-teaching it with his father, David Nickturn, sort of an annual January tradition. And there's still spots left. You can sign up at ny.shambhala.org to dive into this introductory Shambhala Training Weekend, which I recommend. This, however, was a talk he gave about sustaining one's meditation practice. So maybe you've made some new resolutions, right? It's a new year. It's a new you. It's time to renew your relationship with meditation. And hey, I've been there. And it's hard. Boy, it's hard to sustain a meditation practice. So why is it hard? And more importantly, what are some tried and true tips, tricks, hints, suggestions to mitigate the difficulty, to make it easier to sustain a meditation practice? This is the topic of today's talk by Shastri Ethan Nickturn. Now, of course, the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting a week-long meditation retreat in February. This is the week of February 9th, just right around the corner here. David Perrin, another regular contributor to the podcast, is leading this week-long meditation retreat. A meditation retreat in New York City. It's a combination of sitting and walking meditation, Dharma talks, and group discussion and bonding with your fellow meditation compatriots. You can do the whole week. You can sign up for just the first weekend. You can sign up by the day. It's up to you, your schedule, your inspiration. And I think you won't regret it. Go to ny.shambhala.org, click the link on the homepage, Meditation in the City Retreat, for more information and to register. And now, here is Shastri Ethan Nickturn from a talk he gave just a little under a week ago at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York.
So, sort of something I say every year, you probably already know this, that places like this tend to be at maximum capacity right after New Year's. That's actually, that's the joke I would have made like 10 years ago. Now I would say places like this just tend to be at kind of at least on the introductory level, the bring a friend level, the check it out level, which this weekly Dharma gathering definitely fits. Places like this are kind of packed a lot of the time. And there's some difficulty sustaining connection or interest. Is there anybody here who used to feel very connected to a meditation practice or community and then had a disconnect period? Would anyone put yourself in that boat? So that happens a lot. And I think a lot of times it happens, there's a lot of ways we could talk about this, but I wanted to just say a few simple things and then have a discussion. I think the wrong way to approach meditation, definitely from a Buddhist or Shambhala perspective, definitely the wrong way from a perspective of sustainability, is the idea that meditation is going to help you produce an experience. that wasn't happening already. And there are, you can definitely see, those of us who've been teaching for a while get called by people in the so-called mindfulness movement who say, I love everything you do, but I think I know a way to do it better. So I want to hire you or get you to help me produce it, because I think people would really get it. And they don't mean get the teachings. They mean like have an experience, you know? So like, for example, there's a place a block and a half from here called Inscape, which is all about a meditative experience. There's not even a teacher present for teaching the classes. What's that? There's an app, yeah. I mean, there are some great apps that can guide you into a relationship with practice, which is not what I'm talking about here. I think the sort of cliche that of meditation that we have to confront how deep this is and how much we would, how great it would be if this were possible, is the idea that you can use a meditation technique to produce an experience of peace. That's really what I think people are going for when they sign up for the New Year's meditation experience. It's like, I'm going to get my, they usually say Zen, which is so weird because Zen teachers are the most hardcore about not going after peace of any Buddhist tradition. Maybe it's just the most marketable word, I'm not sure. But this notion of like, I'm going to sign up and then I'm going to enter this space and I'm going to feel peace. Now, this is tricky because you could translate, we have many techniques in this tradition, and you could translate the practice we just did, which is known by its Sanskrit name shamatha, in Tibetan it's shine. You could translate that, and it's most often translated as peacefully abiding. So the word peace is in the translation of the technique, but it's a different meaning of peace. I figured this out, that what most people mean when they say, I want to feel peace, is they mean they want to mute their mental experience. And it kind of makes a lot of sense that this would be the first stab at what wisdom or awakening or a good experience is, because there's this feeling, and I know a lot of us felt it last year, that the world is attacking our minds and our minds are attacking us, right? Notification pops up, that attacks you, and then we freak out about it, which attacks us further, right? So if I could just stop, we could just put the phone down, but we're not going to do that. So if we could at least just stop the attack after we get the notification and stop the thoughts and stop the feelings and stop the emotions, kind of be functionally catatonic, that's peace. That is so sad, for one thing. And luckily, it's impossible. And if that's what you're looking for a short period of time, there are much better ways to do that. My favorite is a little bit of wine or whiskey. Some people have other ways, and that could help. These things could actually be skillful means to, sometimes we do need to turn down the volume on the world's attack, and I'm not going to judge with modesty and reasonableness whatever your Netflix, whatever it is for you, that just softens the attack of the world. But a lot of times we think meditation is just going to stop the invasion, stop the invasion of thoughts, feelings, really stop the invasion of humanity into the human system. That's what a lot of people think meditation is. It's really like, oh, and then they want to talk to you and you're like, oh, so could you practice with me? And it's like, do you want to go somewhere else or do you want to be here? And I love that the founder of this tradition, Chogyam Trungpa, who's a very brilliant, like sort of eccentric genius, a real stable genius, but a kind of wild genius at the same time, kind of wild and eccentric but very stable genius. He was ferocious about confronting people's desire to use their spiritual practice or their psychological practice to escape humanity. Right? So here's what I want to say, because it's January, is what this practice is really about is learning to form. It's not about peace, or it's about a definition of peace that is not our conventional definition of peace. It's about forming a relationship with the chaos of one's own mind. And if you're like, but when does the chaos end? Never. I mean, it definitely settles because there's, I don't know, those of you who've practiced for a while or gone on a retreat, most of what we experience as chaos is like the reaction to the chaos. Once we learn how to relate to our own mind a little bit better, that settles down. So there is a settling. There's a stabilizing. There's a maturing, you could say, that I've definitely experienced to a certain degree. But the idea that you are going to someday, as a human being, experience a mind that has nothing relating to it, nothing arising, nothing happening, is neither possible nor really desirable. So we're really trying to form a relationship. And what I want to say is that takes a long time. And it's okay to stop doing it for 6 months or 6 years and then come back. But I want to say this in terms of science, they have actually proven that just doing meditation practice for a short period of time is actually quite helpful. It's way better than all the other things. You know, like when they did the 8-week course of mindfulness-based stress reduction is the one that has been probably the Buddhist-inspired, and that one is Buddhist-inspired, by the way, sort of secularized meditative course that has been the most studied in clinical environments. And even doing it for 8 weeks, they found the positive effects are amazing. But they don't... You don't finish a weekend retreat here. You don't sit every day for a week for 7 days or until your app gives you the virtual sticker. Yay! 30 days in a row on Insight Timer. And then you don't have to deal with your mind. It takes a really long time to form a relationship. There's a quote you may have heard that's probably totally muddled. It's attributed to the Dalai Lama. I doubt he ever actually said it. But sometimes the way good spiritual quotes are is if they're good, you just give them to somebody you respect. So attributed to the Dalai Lama or some other master is the quote that you should check in on how your meditation practice is progressing, meaning how it's having effects in your life, once every 10 years. And Westerners seem to want to do it once every 10 minutes. So that's my selling point. What's your path going to be like in 2028? Probably not what you wanted to hear. You want to hear like power of now, like I could just switch. Right? I could just flip a switch. There are actually techniques, going to teach and work with one of them this weekend in our tradition called Wind Horse or Lung Ta, where you could recall a presence, recall a confidence, recall an openness or compassion very quickly. There are sort of ways to give, for the video game generation, kind of power boosts to our awareness, but they still have to be put in the context of a long ongoing relationship with our own heart and mind. And so anybody who's saying, I woke up suddenly, I believe them, if it looks like they did. Like if you look at somebody like an Eckhart Tolle, it actually looks like that person went through a pretty strong transformation. There's something shifted, right? But I like the way that, and I quoted this in The Road Home, one of the acharyas or master teachers in our lineage, Pema Chodron, who my friend Brett referred to as the Shambhala gateway drug, which I loved. We love you, Pema. Pema Chodron was once asked if the path was sudden or gradual. This is a long debate in Buddhist history, if awakening is sudden or gradual. And her answer is the best answer to anything. And she said, that's a funny question. I always thought that sudden was the result of a heck of a lot of gradual. So we're really trying to form a committed relationship with ourselves. That's what meditation is. You get married to yourself. And even if you don't believe in marriage, which a lot of my friends don't, you do have to get, you are already married to yourself. It already happened by accepting birth. I do. And so that's what we're working with here. So I just, this is not so much about the quick fix. Now, that being said, let's pull it back to like what we can do in January and what is helpful. And I think we come from a world, if you watch like sports, for example, there's this real narrative of just this like intensely machismo, libertarian, solitary, like, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to hit the gym every day. CrossFit, you know, triathlon, I'm training. And if I don't do it, it's my failure. It was a lack of some kind of discipline, some kind of drive, you know, some kind of willpower. I lacked it, right? And this is the way we feel a lot of times when we get off of our any kind of practice that we're doing. And practice here just means long-term process that we're going through. If anybody's ever tried to write something longer or, you know, is prepping for a series of paintings for a show and your mind wanders and you procrastinate, there's this feeling, this very American feeling of like, I lost my willpower, and you want to kind of slap yourself back into shape. Now, discipline, hard work, good work ethic, these are all amazing things, but they actually come from this tradition standpoint from places that we don't often credit them with. I was recently interviewing and talking with a psychotherapist and mindfulness teacher named Elijah Goldstein, who's based in Los Angeles. And he was talking about the research of the primary things that make a meditation practice sustainable. And the two things that he talked about as being the things that we each need is, he said, we need a community, basically, which means we need people in our life who remind us of our practice. What does this not mean? This does not mean that if you're in a relationship with somebody who doesn't meditate, you need to break up with them. It's a question I get a lot. Not in that direct a way, but sort of talking around it. Like, is this going to work? It does not mean you need to stop hanging out with your friends who don't meditate. It doesn't mean you need to quit your job and move to a meditation center where you assume everybody is awakened bodhisattvas, only to find out that they are as neurotic, if not more neurotic, than the people that you knew in New York. But it means that we need people in our life who remind us of our intention to practice. Right? That's the narrative that Sangha, community, overcomes, is actually this notion that people do things alone. People don't do things alone. Interdependence, that's one of the core teachings of Buddhism. Nobody has ever done anything by themselves. So you need help. And some things that could be very helpful coming here or another place that's better for you, if you can't make it here, then having a practice buddy or three who you folks like text each other. I have a group of four or five friends who, because one of the people was in a very high-pressure, high-profile political job and is a meditator and wanted help, and so we created this sort of email check-in, and it's a great thing to do. You could do it via text. You could do it however you want, where you text each other, practiced, you know, did loving kindness meditation or Tonglen compassion meditation for 20 minutes and also went on a bad date or, and also, you know, gave a lecture I was nervous about at the Shambhala Center and also, you know, did this thing or that thing. And so it's a check-in. It's friends practicing together. But it reminds you, like, oh, there are other people who care about me who are also practicing. I call that like a micro-sangha. And then there's a regular sangha, which is being part of a community, which gives a lot of support. It's full of annoying people like me. So it's not like these are going to be your only friends or your best friends. It's just a place where people share some values and some desire to support each other in their practice of awakening. That's one part. The other part of that notion of our environment is that it's good to have an enriched environment for practice. One of the best things about having a spot in your home that is your meditation spot, you could have a zabuton, the flat cushions, you could have your blanket and your yoga block, you could have a chair that's like your mindful chair, and the chair is more mindful than the other chairs, and it's in front of a candle or it's in front of a statue of a great being that you respect, or a picture of a being who reminds you of the qualities you're trying to develop. And you have that spot, and then it has power in your home. You know, that's the thing. The things that have a place in the places we go are the things that get done. Have you noticed that? So people say, like, what's with the shrine? Right? My friend Lodro Rinzler has his studio, and they don't have a shrine. They have this gorgeous moss wall. Much less, unless you're allergic or something, much less confrontational than having a shrine. But most people I know have a shrine in their homes. It's called their television. It's a central object that sends out messages and reminders about how to be a human in this society. That's what a shrine is. So the people on our shrine are the two heads of this Western lineage, Shogyam Trungpa, and my personal teacher, his son, Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. And in the middle of the shrine, there's a non-human and non-gendered representation of what's called a Rigdin, which is the sort of a archetypal figure in the Shambhala teachings. It's the version of a Buddha, an enlightened person or being, who attains awakening as a leader in society. It's a representation of societal awakening. So it's weird because we didn't know that, but if you like these two gentlemen or have received teachings that come from them, or you like the idea of societal awakening, or you formed a connection with this space, then all of a sudden it's a reminder for being a compassionate person in society. So you don't have to have this shrine. you don't actually ever have to have this shrine, even if you become a card-carrying, there's no card, there's just pins, member of Shambhala. But to enrich your space with, like, I'm actually going to make this the place where I am cultivating these qualities can be helpful. So community and enriched environment. That's one element of sustaining a practice. Okay, let's get to the nitty-gritty. I want to say two more aspects of a sustainable practice. Space in your schedule. It's very interesting. If you look, how many people like actually have a calendar? Like you live life that way, like either online or... Anybody still have a paper calendar? Yeah. So if you look, and this is the way expression works in general, right? There's negative space, which in a Tibetan sense has to do with the feminine qualities, actually, not man and woman, but masculine and feminine. And then there's the positive space, right? So there's unclaimed time, and then there's claimed time. And usually what we're really nervous about is claiming the time that matters, that has to do with paying the rent or mortgage, that has to do with, like, is this going to affect what other people think of me immediately? That better go in. Is this something I'm accountable to? And what ends up happening is that the negative space on the calendar becomes valueless. It's waiting to be filled. Right. And this is part of the way it's so interesting how much outside of real estate, where space is incredibly valuable in our world, in fact, on this island, probably more than anywhere else, maybe San Francisco, I don't know, close to anywhere else. Physical space is important, but space that's not immediately productive is devalued. So here's the interesting thing. If you're actually taking this approach of, like, this is like cultivating stuff about how I'm going to be as a person in 2028, we have to shift our value system. We have to start filling in the space with things that are not immediate threats or payoffs. And you have to kind of retrain. It's almost like a form of affirmative action for your practice. You have to, because it's been devalued in an artificial way, because our limbic systems don't look at long-term cultivation, you have to say, these 20 minutes, not negotiable. Not after everything else. Because if you do practice after everything else, something's going to come along and say, you got to handle me now. That's the way this works. There will always be something that is more immediately alarming in your schedule than your meditation or Dharma practice. So sometimes we have to, because we live in such a masculinized world, we have to literally put it on the calendar and mean it. And like not, no, you know. I'm not going to let that space be taken over. So it's a prioritizing of the space that's about long-term activities. And you could do something reasonable, please. Don't do like, I'm going to do 7 days a week, an hour a day, unless you're currently doing 6 days a week, 55 minutes a day. Do like 3 times a week. Because that way, if you do 4 times a week, 10, 15, 20 minutes of practice, then you feel like you exceeded expectation. And so we are trying to bring minds that have grown accustomed to always feeling like failures into doing something that has long-term benefits. And we have to be able to actually appreciate when we do practice. And if you do practice, thank yourself for practicing. Don't get up from 20 minutes and be like, wow, that was useless. I am a worthless. I mean, are other people's minds this bad? Get up from practice and be like, oh, that was interesting. There was a lot in there. Huh. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for practicing. We have an actual practice at the end of practice where you dedicate the merit. You say merit was generated, benefits happened that I may not be able to see in the short term from my efforts to practice. I'm going to offer them to my future path and dun 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 to other people. Both to self and other. Remember, there are other people? There are other people. This is going to help them too. They matter too, but it's not that they're the only ones that matter. We matter first. So creating the space for practice. And the other thing I'll say is that study and having an actual path is helpful and important. It gives your mind things to contemplate, experiences to process. It relates you to community. It relates you to teachers you respect who can give you feedback and guidance. There are a lot of meditation groups and centers growing up where it's just about the practice. And I think some of that's good because some people are not interested in a whole lineage or tradition or body of teachings. There was sort of been a movement, the idea that if you actually study Buddhism, that it's like a religious thing and you might just be interested in the scientific or psychological or nervous system benefits of meditation. So let's not talk about like the four thises and the seven thats. Let's not bow. And I get that, you know, when you're moving into a world that we live in where the notion of spiritual reality and secular reality are seemingly so distanced, you want to know who you're talking to. I actually heard the opposite. This is how popular this stuff has become. I was speaking with a student, and they said, I'm really interested in the mind. I'm really interested in studying meditation with you, but is it okay that I'm not sure I'm interested in Buddhism? And I was like, yeah, of course. What am I going to tell you? It's not okay. You know, I assumed that this person was coming from the perspective of either having a different spiritual background, so not wanting to, you know, messy up the waters, so to speak, with studying multiple traditions, or they were coming from the perspective of strong kind of atheistic beliefs, which is another spiritual set of beliefs, by the way. It's another way to take a guess about what's going on here. But it turned out that I was wrong. They didn't have spiritual aversion to studying Buddhism. They said, no, I don't have spiritual aversion. It's like what all the cool people are doing. And I don't want to be like that person who's chasing a fad. I was like, oh, okay, this is new territory. So what I will say is, to study a tradition, you don't have to identify with the tradition. I do, because I've taken that vow. There are certain moments where you actually say, okay, I'm part of this tradition. But to study the tradition, it just gives us a context of a wider body of teachings, including philosophy, including teachings on the nature of the mind, and including ethics, including what you do, how you work with your mind, how you work with yourself, how you work with others off of your practice cushion or seat. And it's what I'll say is the mindfulness movement that is just looking at, like, we're afraid of religion, so we're just looking at stripped down one sort of little strand of these teachings is just that. It's stripped down. It's a good start. So if you do have fears about, like, actually studying a tradition, practicing within a tradition, I just want to, I hope, this is really what I try to embody as a practitioner and teacher more than anything else. It is completely possible to study a tradition and still be you. It doesn't ask, it asks for a lot, but it doesn't actually ask for anything that isn't worth giving up anyway. And it doesn't make you be like a different person. Sometimes people mistake and they say, if I'm going to be a Buddhist, I have to like change my tone of voice. And that is scary. I agree. I know you're scared of that. I am also scared of that. Those people scare me. Some of them are friends with mine. They still scare me. You know. So having a path and having a path of study, which could just be reading and contemplation too, augments practice. So what did I say? Long term, I said that it's about having an enriched environment and a community. I said that it's about really prioritizing space for practice in a reasonable way in your calendar, and it's about having a path of study. If you do all those things, you will sometimes not want to practice, but the blips in your sustainable practice will be relatively small. And I will see you if we're still here in 2028. And if more of us do these things in our own way, there's a higher chance that we will all still be here in 2028. So thoughts, questions, disagreements, your own perspectives?
This just reminded me of, my mom actually sent me a link to an article in the New York Times about keeping New Year's resolutions and how to do it. And I just thought this was interesting because it popped into my head as we were talking about this in this idea of maintaining a practice. And it talks about actually the most effective way of keeping any resolution is by practicing gratitude and the actual scientific benefit of that.
Yeah.
It's a really amazing article. If anyone has not read it, I highly recommend it because it's another great like perspective on how to mentally navigate this idea of keeping a practice and not be at war with yourself, basically.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I think there are a lot of gratitude practices in this tradition. I think the simplest way is at the end of one's meditation, even if it's 5 minutes, you offer gratitude to yourself for having made it.
Yeah.
Let's just take a few folks left, because that's what happens. Let's just take a minute. Everybody made it here tonight. Just take a minute to feel how weirdly, uncomfortably optimistic it feels to just take a moment to acknowledge the merit of your practice. So to thank yourself for making it here and practicing. And then just think about how you could actually offer that merit, offer whatever positive qualities are cultivated to yourself in the future and also to other beings. I'll just recite, we do a chant in the Shambhala tradition, which includes one Tibetan word, which is Rigdin, which is the societal Buddha on the shrine. This is how we dedicate the merit after a meditation session in Shambhala. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdin's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. How does that feel? Good? Weird? Good. So, yeah, it's the other aspect of why gratitude is so transformative is what some psychologists and especially a Buddhist evolutionary biologist named Rick Hansen talks about, which is the negativity bias of our mammalian and also reptilian nervous systems, which we are constantly looking for threats, which means that we are literally biased towards consciously intaking more negative or threatening information than positive information. We are misreading reality to the negative. So gratitude sort of shifts the yoga stretch in the other direction. So it's actually, optimistic people are actually being more realistic from a scientific standpoint. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. You? No. Do you have anything to add? No. Okay.
I was wondering, I've been looking at, there's so many varieties and types of meditation. You could do walking meditation, you could do, you know, you could produce sounds, you could, you know. I'm just curious about, with all of these different varieties and kinds and types of meditation, is there like a reason or a better reason for why like this basic sitting meditation might be better, or could you do any of these things?
Yeah. Yeah. So in this tradition, there are many different, this tradition is based on Tibetan Buddhism, which tends to be, at least in the Buddhist context, one of the broadest traditions of teachings in terms of different techniques and practices that are incorporated into the tradition. So you could, just within the context of the Shambhala path, I bet I've received like over 100 different meditation techniques, not to talk about studying with other teachings, which can be like, it's like when you decide you have too many channels on television, you know? So the beautiful thing that I like about the Shambhala curriculum is you sort of are introduced to new techniques in a context where you can actually sort of incorporate them into when and how they're useful. What you said is kind of using the word basic, I think, kind of actually encapsulates it, which I know in millennial or post-millennial culture, when you call something basic, it's a diss, right? Is that true? I'm almost 40, so I need like help on these things. I know what diss means. But here what basic means, and it's the same as in the notion of basic goodness, is meaning at the base, at the foundation, that from which other things grow. So every technique is based on a basic relationship to mindfulness and awareness, and that's what, in most Buddhist traditions, working with the breath, working with embodiment, working with some aspect of mindfulness and awareness is the basic foundational technique. So even in our tradition, when you're later doing practices to rouse one's confidence, like the wind horse practice that I mentioned, or intense sort of liturgies of visualization where you imagine awakened beings being present with you, and where you imagine yourself inhabiting the form of an awakened being, you start with shamatha practice to settle in, to take your seat to ground. So it is a basic practice, but it's more basic in the sense of a yoga, like when people say basic yoga class, I mean, you're going to learn the foundation, and then in the intermediate class, you're going to grow from that foundation. You're not going to forget everything you learned. So we always start at the base. So if you want to learn something new, go deeper into the path. If you want to learn something new by just going to lots of different places, there's a Zen teacher named Roshi Bernie Glassman who has this great analogy of digging a well. And what he says is there are many places that you could dig a well to reach fresh water underneath, but you have to dig one hole deep enough to get there. You can't just dig a little bit at a lot of different places. And, you know, that's the tricky part, because there is, different traditions are in conversation with each other. They have a lot of wisdom. Those of us who go deeper on the Shambhala path, we bring a lot of the other things we're studying into this space. And you can look up a lot of teachings online. You can YouTube Tantra, you know. But it's it's the notion of learning and working and practicing with things in a communal and sort of a held context of a lineage with teachers and fellow practitioners that is powerful. If you want to go deeper, I would say grow from a base rather than do what Trung Rinpoche called the spiritual buffet. Stable genius.
Kind of going off of that, I just want to share my own personal practice experience. And about a year ago, I was unemployed for several months, and so it was very easy for me to do 30 minutes a day every day. And I kind of got very on a high horse about it. But I started to notice that just because I was practicing 30 minutes a day, it wasn't necessarily, I wasn't necessarily being a warrior in every moment of my life outside of those 30 minutes. And so I decided to get into volunteering here at the center a lot more. And it was extremely helpful, but at the same time, only, living my life externally and trying to, getting away from the cushion, I found it exhausting at the same time. And so I found exactly what you're saying. You have to, ground yourself with that, It doesn't have to be 30 minutes every day, but, it's being kind to yourself and just kind of, there's a million things you could do. You could bring your practice into every moment of your life, but in my personal experience, the sitting actually helps me bring my practice into the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. One or two more? Everybody ready to go do this? Like 7 times this week for an hour? Wait, that's not what I said. 3 times this week? 15 minutes? Offering the merit of the practice after you do it in whatever way? If anybody's into the Shambhala chant, I can totally email that to you. If you're totally not into it, you could just say, this is for me and this is for everyone else. And thanks for doing it. That's a dedication of merit. One class I used to teach, we used to do the freestyle dedication of merit. One person would just kind of spontaneously offer it, but those were the good old days.
One thing I struggle with in my practice and basically derailed my practice before, but now I'm back doing it, is just judging myself for having the constant thoughts. I was meditating a lot every day, and I was in the Zen practice. Mm-hmm. That's still my main practice, but I guess finding the balance between not judging myself for having the constant thoughts mm-hmm. and also not just like allowing my thoughts to just go and I don't know, I guess my problem is probably being too hard on myself, but it could also be possible to not be, having that discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very unique problem. No, it's, there's something, there does seem to be some kind of awakening in some parts of our world. And what I just hope comes out of that is this realization of how many people are in the same boat of, like, I'm really hard on myself. So it's interesting when you bring a mind that's really hard on itself and is always constantly saying, I'm not doing good enough. And then you give it a mindfulness technique to do, which is just like watching. Now you have this like very simplified arena for you to just kind of project what failing now means, And it would be good if there was just some kind of confidence that came in and said, wait a minute. So what's wrong with thinking? Why is that a bad thing? I agree, you said it, that you have, and what's your name?
Will,
an experience, which I also have. Sometimes if there's no relationship to the thought, if there's no sort of working with the thought, it can just be like feel like a wild horse, kind of, And so there's something to be done. There is a discipline. There's a desire to gather the mind, to relate to the mind. But it's not that the mind is bad. That's actually what got us into this mess, is thinking we were bad. So we have to find a way to harness the mind, to gather it without beating ourselves up. That's what this path is. And that's what the idea of basic goodness, which is the root of these teachings, is. And the way to do that, I'm going to give you an analogy that comes from the Japanese Zen tradition. Great, one of the, in addition to Chogyam Trungpa, one of the real masters of bringing Buddhist thought to the Western world in the mid-late 20th century, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. In his book that you may have seen, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he says the way to train a wild animal is to give it a wide pasture. So there's still a pasture. There's still some containment, but it's in actually a loving place, and there's a lot of open space to explore. So whatever technique you're working with, just look at it as like the pasture rather than like the prison. I found a better way to put my mind in jail, you know? That's what a lot of people do with their meditation technique, is like... and so, yeah, that's really the challenge, is how to actually work with our mind, realize sometimes it gets out of control. We have some great examples in public life of really, like, you want to know what a few more lifetimes down that road looks like, just turn on the TV. It's great impetus to practice. Also great impetus to register people to vote, which is one of the things I'm working on this year in my off-the-cushion practice. Remind them to vote. Not try to convince anyone of anything, but just good impetus for us to say, I'm going to work with being kind to myself and harnessing my mind. But we have to do that without replicating the problem of hating ourselves. We have to train without hating ourselves, and it feels so much like every form of training that we've learned is about stopping bad me from getting out of control rather than cultivating basically good me. That's what meditation is, cultivating the you that is already fundamentally awake and compassionate and probably is thinking a lot of brilliant thoughts. I don't even know you, Will.
Well, thank you.
Probably a lot of those thoughts are wonderful, insightful, helpful to both yourself and others. They're just a little unharnessed sometimes. So, okay. Please feel free to make yourselves at home here. And if you have another place to go that's better for you, please be there as much as you can. And please participate in the world this year. I think this is going to be a good year. A lot of problems. But I think if we take the approach of being practitioners, steady, this is going to be a good year. So I hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Shastri Ethan Nickturn. Visit our website, nmy.shambhala.org, for more information and to register for either Ethan Nickturn's Shambhala Training Weekend 1, coming up this weekend, the weekend of January 19th, or our week-long meditation retreat, the Meditation in the City Retreat, the week of February 2nd. Or any of our other upcoming offerings this winter and spring. ny.shambhala.org. Click classes and programs to see our full menu of what's going on. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. But if you are in the New York City area, our weekly Dharma gathering is every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Later.